I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, I speak with composer Paul Moravec and Dr. Malcolm Merriweather about Sanctuary Road at the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. Sanctuary Road, an oratorio composed by Moravec with librettist Mark Campbell, draws inspiration from the powerful accounts of abolitionist William Still, honoring the courage of those who fought for freedom from slavery. Also on the program, Margaret Bond's Montgomery Variations offers a moving musical tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement, capturing the enduring struggle for justice and equality. Sanctuary Road will be presented by the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra on Saturday, March 29th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, March 30th at 2:30 p.m. at Klein Hans Music Hall. Tickets are available in the show notes and at bpo.org. In this interview, we discuss the importance of a piece like Sanctuary Road, why programming pieces like this is important, and what audiences may consider after the program. First is my interview with Paul. Well, Moravec, thank you so much for speaking with me today. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
I'd love to start off by asking, with someone who has your incredible output and relationship to the art form, what is your earliest recollection of music?
The most impressive early memory is seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. I think it was February, whatever day it was. They appeared on national television, and it was a sensation for the whole country, including me. And I was 6 years old, and I wanted to be a Beatle. So that was my first really impressive experience with music.
Wow. When did you start composing?
I started composing actually in Buffalo. And we lived on Lakeshore Drive in Hamburg. And my first compositions I wrote when I was about 10 or 11. And they were for the piano, which I was taking at the time. And one of my earliest really important compositions I wrote for the church at St. Paul's Cathedral. I was the head chorister of St. Paul's Cathedral in Buffalo in the early 70s. And I wrote this piece, I guess, in 75 or so. And that was a big deal for me to have, this chorus and organ premiere this piece of mine at the cathedral. So that's one of my, early accomplishments as a composer, I would say.
That's incredible. Beyond that project, was there another project, or was it that project that really felt like solidified your identity as a composer?
You mean the piece for Saint?
Yeah, or just beyond that, right? Like, what was the what was the moment, I guess I'm asking, that you felt, this is my life. I'm a composer. Like, this is what I do.
There was no particular moment. I just sort of fell in love with the whole idea of being a composer. And by the age of 12, I just decided this is what I want to do. And at this point in my life, it's all I know how to do. So I can't do anything else, really. Being a composer is a kind of calling. I mean, you don't really choose to be a composer. The art form comes to you. And I guess the way I would put it is to say that there is something inside me that sang and that still sings, and that I need to give voice to and to notate in musical notation and so on, and give to other musicians to have them perform and so on. And it's a great joy, as somebody once said, making music is the most fun you can have with your clothes on, and a great thing about being a composer is that you are in contact you know, 24/7, nonstop, with something that constantly renews you, constantly inspires you, that gives you joy, you know, and that's a great privilege. So I consider it, you know, it's hard work, you know, and being a composer is, practically speaking, very, very, it's a hard row to hoe, you know, and that's a whole other discussion, but the experience of being a composer is when the work is going well, it's absolutely joyous, and I wouldn't do anything else.
My next question actually really is about the day-to-day work. What's a typical day like when you're writing and composing?
Well, here I am. This is my axe here. This is, I make music with my hands, you know, in a way. My music is handmade. I need to sit at the piano and hear the music that I'm thinking of and trying to articulate. And I'm absolutely convinced that a musician's hands, if they use them in making music, are an extension of the brain and the central nervous system. And when you've been doing it a very, very long time, it becomes, you know, natural and second nature to you and so on. And very often my fingers will find the solution that I'm looking for as I'm working on a piece, even before my ears do, you know, if that makes sense. You know, it's kind of eerie in a way, you know. And think about what your hands do when you're playing, for example, a fugue by Bach, you know, Johann Sebastian Bach. Your fingers are doing pretty much what his fingers did, you know, 350 years ago. So there is this visceral connection that you have and that I have with Bach in that sense, that, you know, much greater imagination and you know, he was a genius on, you know, the highest level. And somehow that makes me smarter as a composer somehow. And it's a visceral physical connection that transcends time and space. And, you know, it's kind of an eerie time traveling, space traveling thing that we sort of take for granted.
Yes, yes. I'd love to ask, just because you made reference to the piano behind you, is all of your music still, and what you said about sort of working with your hands is so beautiful. Do you ever use digital assistants when writing, or is everything handwritten?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for the last 20 years, I have been using a program called Sibelius, which is absolutely terrific and saves so much time. But still, when I write a piece, I do it the old-fashioned medieval way, you know, which everybody did until about 1995 or so when these things came in, you know. There was only one way to write down music, and that was it, you know, actually pen to paper, you know. So,
well, your work runs the gamut from, you've written for the ballet, you've written oratorios, you've written for the opera, for chamber ensembles. I'd love to ask, and I know this is an incredibly unfair question, but I feel the more interviews I have, the more I feel sort of privileged to ask unfair questions. If there was one element that you felt was present in all of your work, what would that one element be?
Love. And connected to that, joy. I try to make joyous things. Always, even if they're heavy subjects and so on, at the end of the day, I want it to be a joyous experience somehow, something that transcends suffering and hardship and et cetera, et cetera. Partly because, I want to make beautiful things. So I would say, you know, love, joy, and beauty, that trinity.
That's beautiful. I'm so interested that you said that to sort of segue to my next question, which is about the things that inspire you to write. I know that you wrote an opera of The Shining. Is that correct? And you've also been inspired by W. Somerset Maugham, who's such a brilliant and underrated author, one of my favorite authors. What inspires you to write things like this?
Well, in the case of The Shining, that idea came from Minnesota Opera. They wanted to commission me for something. And we were looking at a lot of different projects. We even looked at Rosemary's Baby. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, I sure do. And now I'm like, man, I would love to see that.
Yeah, we couldn't get the rights. Maybe someday, who knows? In any event, and then one day, Dale Johnson was the head of Minnesota Opera, and he sent me an email. He said, "Hey, how about The Shining?" And I went, "What an idea!" You know, my God, you know. And so what we did is we adapted the book and not the movie, because the movie, if you're a fan of the movie, you'll know that it's not really exactly what Stephen King wrote. And in fact, Stephen King doesn't like the Kubrick film, you know. Now, what Kubrick did is brilliant, and because he's Kubrick and it's an amazing movie and so on. That's not what we did. We did the book, which is not icy and cold and cynical the way Kubrick is, and Jack Nicholson and all that. The book is actually, it's a warm love story, and it's about a family trying to stay together under extraordinary duress, you know. So, and it's in the horror genre, but I don't think of it as a horror story. It really transcends the genre. It's just a great story, you know. And in the opera, you know, as we follow the book, think about, people say, "Oh my God, it must be incredibly violent and all that," you know. Actually, Tosca is more violent than The Shining. I mean, the body count is higher. There's only one death in The Shining, you know. The rest are ghosts. They're already dead. So that's something else, you know. But anyways, so that's what attracts me, because I love to tell compelling stories. And in the case of opera, opera is always about love, death, and power. And boy, and The Shining has all of three of those elements in there, you know, on steroids. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know.
In preparing for an interview, when you're researching to speak to someone, you try to sort of look for connections. And sometimes the connections can be slightly unfair. But the sort of themes that I sort of saw looking kind of cursory through your catalog include themes around nature, history, and literature. And I think that music captures something that the written word does not, right? Mm-hmm. In the experience of kind of nature, history, or literature, can you talk about maybe the feeling or whatever it is that can be captured by music that can't be captured by the written word?
Well, I think of music as enhancing the words, and I guess we should talk about something specifically, and let's talk about Sanctuary Road, which is coming up March 29 and 30. Is
that That's right? Correct.
And I wanted to write, the Oratorio Society of New York, Kent Tridle, asked me to write an oratorio for them. And I had the idea to make it about the Underground Railroad. Now, customarily, we think about oratorios as on religious subjects. Almost all of them are. I mean, it started out in Rome, you know, and it started out as a, you know, strictly religious kind of unstaged music drama. But I had the idea of using secular story here, in this case, the story of the Underground Railroad, as seen by William Still, who is one of the most consequential figures in the whole history of the Underground Railroad, particularly in the 1850s. He was based in Philadelphia. So my librettist and I, my brilliant librettist, Mark Campbell, took a book called The Underground Railroad Records, which he published after the Civil War. Because what he did was, he was in Philadelphia and he had the advantage of being born a free Black. So he had the advantage of literacy. He was, you know, essentially a middle class, he was a middle class guy. He had a comfortable life in Philadelphia, well respected in the community. So he used that position to help something like 1,000 fugitive slaves, like Harriet Tubman, for example, help them to escape to the North. And in most cases, he sent them on to Canada, because it wasn't just enough to be in the North after 1850 or so. So anyways, that's an amazingly compelling story. And the question about setting a music drama, and that's what we did, that's what it is. Why are people singing? Why don't you just speak it, you know? So that's the first question that the composer has to ask about a subject. And in the case of Sanctuary Road, it sings, it naturally sings. There's so much, you know, tremendous emotion, and there's so much at stake. It's the narratives that we tell in that actually William Still tells in his book, and that we then set to music, you know, are just tremendously compelling and moving and dramatic, and it's the stuff of music drama. You know, that's what we do. So yeah, that inspires me, certainly, a story like this.
And let's ask a follow-up question with that, in terms of, as you were working through the piece, which I'm sure was at times heavy and difficult and emotional, what surprised you about this? What sort of came out on the page?
Nothing really.
That's fair. Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing, you know, somebody asked me, you know, you wrote an oratorio about the Underground Railroad. You know, are there spirituals in it? You know, somebody asked, you know, is there, or how about blues, you know, or something like this. And first of all, to use spirituals in Sanctuary Road, it's certainly justified, but it would just be so incredibly corny. You know, it's too obvious. And, you know, so, and in any event, I'm not very good at pastiche. I just write what I write, and it just comes out, you know, the way I sound, you know. And in the case of blues, it would have been anachronistic, because the blues are really a 20th century phenomenon. So in any event, so I just wrote what I felt like. And the way I do that is I let the characters tell me how they want to sound, you know. And in that sense, I'm kind of a method composer. If you think about a method actor like Marlon Brando or whatever, they inhabit their being somehow. So then they sing through me and I sing through them. And it becomes this kind of, I don't know, unusual, you know, identification that goes on. So.
Sam, thank you. As the audience listens to the piece, is there anything that you hope they experience or consider when listening to it, or just even a theme that you might want to point them to, or would you like them just to have their own experience?
This oratorio is about one word: freedom. That's it. And the word free appears early on, and it's the last word in the entire oratorio. It's about the struggle for freedom, and after all of this struggle and suffering and drama in the course of the oratorio, it ultimately is triumphant. There's a kind of apotheosis at the end in which everybody wins, you know. I mean, who doesn't want to be free, you know? So there are aspects to this story that are timeless and universal. And I think that that's what draws the audience in. And so the feeling at the end, I think, is one of joy and triumph. So you just have to hear it. You have to see the whole thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that I've done so many interviews for the BPO, and one thing that is consistently echoed is the incredible programming at the BPO and the sort of just variety and diversity of pieces that are programmed at the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. I was wondering if you'd maybe speak on, like, why is programming a piece like Sanctuary Road so important to an organization like the BPO?
Well, that's up to them. I mean, I guess you could ask them, but I think that it's important. Telling a story like this, I will presume, I'll be, you know, say something arrogantly, I guess, which is that these stories are not just Sanctuary Road, but the other oratorios that Mark and I have written. These stories are worth telling by anyone and to anyone at any time and in any place. And I keep coming back to aspects of these oratorios that we've written on historical subjects. And you're hearing the voices actually in their own words. And in the case of William Still, a lot of it is his own words, its own writing. And I think of a story like this as ordinary Americans caught up in extraordinary circumstances and what happens and how do they react and how they respond. And very often their language is remarkably reticent. I mean, they're talking about, you know, cataclysmic, huge, you know, epic emotions and so on, and issues and so on, in the most ordinary terms. And there's something to me that's really moving about that. You know, it's like an actor who will tell you that what makes an audience cry is not crying. The actor is not going to cry. It's the sight of the actor trying not to cry, you know, and that's what this kind of language, this kind of oratorio has. It has a kind of, you know, superpower in that way. Very subtle, very subtle.
Thank you very much. Those are my questions, and I will include the in the show notes places where we can get tickets, and all the information for the upcoming performance on March 29th and 30th at the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. But I always like to end my interviews by asking, is there anything that you feel is left unsaid or anything that you'd like to share with our listeners? And if the answer is no, that's okay.
Tell your friends. Wake the kids, phone the neighbors, come out and see it. I know how this sounds. I'm just a guy from Buffalo. I'm not a boastful person, but I will tell you, it's a spectacular experience, and I highly recommend it. You will not be disappointed. And if you are, keep it to yourself. Don't tell me. If there's one thing I'm sure of, I promise you, you will come away thinking, wow. Oh, I want to say, give a shout out to Malcolm Merriweather, who couldn't be on this call. Malcolm has been the baritone soloist in just about every iteration of this oratorio, you know, since 2018. And he's conducting. So this will be his conducting debut at the Philharmonic. He's fantastic. He's one of the most talented people I know. And I was the head chorister of St. Paul's Cathedral Men and Boys Choir in the early 70s. He was the head chorister of the same choir, sat in the same pew, the same seat as I did, I believe, in 1995. You know, so that's an experience that we have in common. He's a native Buffalonian.
That's fantastic.
So come out and support the home team. Here we go.
Exactly. Thank you so much. It was fantastic talking to you. Next is my interview with Dr. Malcolm Merriweather. Dr. Malcolm Merriweather, thank you so much for chatting with me today. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm here in New York City and excited to talk to you about conducting the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra.
Fantastic. Now, you are a Western New York local originally, is that correct?
That's correct. I grew up on Grand Island and went to Grand Island Central Schools, spent a lot of time making music throughout Western New York until I went off to college.
Fantastic. I always like to ask, just by starting off, do you have, like, what's your earliest recollection of music, or maybe loving music, or feeling like music has to be a part of my life?
Well, I'm thinking back to one of my earliest sort of large scale music making experiences, which was singing in the children's chorus for Bach's St. Matthew Passion with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. And I must have been about 8 years old, but I can remember being, you know, on stage at Kleinhans, the symphonic choir behind us, and we were in our choir robes, and we had a small part. I remember sitting for a long time, but just the immense beauty of the orchestra and being sort of surrounded by that sound definitely sticks out.
Was there a project that you felt really solidified your identity as a musician?
Absolutely. My senior year of high school, I was cast as the lead Emile Debec in South Pacific. And I sang Some Enchanted Evening on the opening night of the show, and the audience really went wild and they were applauding, and the applause seemed to go on forever. And it was in that moment that I really was sort of emboldened to embark on a career in music.
Fantastic. You started as a performer, and I know now that you, I think, still perform, but you are also a conductor. You are a conductor. There really isn't like a direct road, I think, to conducting in the same way in terms of theater. Like, there's not a direct road often into directing. How did you come into the art form of conducting?
That's a great question. Well, I think all great conductors have an instrument. They start off and playing piano or violin or horn, and mine happened to be voice. And I still am actively singing as a soloist throughout the world, actually. So I'm very lucky to have that dual career. But my introduction to conducting was actually in my undergraduate studies at Syracuse University, where I was the music director for my a cappella group, which is called Orange Appeal. So it was through that sort of extracurricular activity that I really got excited about music directing and ultimately conducting. So I began, you know, taking conducting classes, and I was an intern with the Syracuse Children's Chorus. And then from there, it just sort of unfolded in my subsequent degrees in conducting.
Can you describe the feeling when conducting is at its best, or when you really feel that you're in the pocket?
The best part of conducting for me is actually rehearsals. That is when I think the magic is made and ultimately solidified in performance. But there's something about working in rehearsals, non-verbally and verbally, of course, to get orchestras, to get choirs, to really realize whatever piece they're performing. So in performance, the best, let's see, in performance, the best thing for me as a conductor is when I can really not get in the way of the music, and it just happens because we've rehearsed and we've done our job in rehearsal.
Thank you. I found that answer to be so thrilling, but also so surprising, right? I didn't exactly know what the answer you'd give, but I never thought it would be in rehearsal. But that is kind of a really magical sort of space in any sort of artistic maker's life, right? Or artistic maker's process, to have that kind of collaborative space and to see that things come together. Thank you so much for that answer. I think sometimes too, conducting can be one of those art forms where people have an understanding of what it is, but at a certain point, sometimes don't see that like conductors can do different things to different pieces. So if you listen to a Handel piece conducted by one person, it can sound or feel or have a completely different texture or something conducted by someone else. I'd love to know, is there an element in every piece of music that you work on that you want to bring to the forefront of the listening experience? Or is there an aspect of process or something that you're returning to when you start kind of either researching a piece or looking at it that you feel, this is what I want to bring forward in this music?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing I look at is the text, or if the music is programmatic, I start with that inspiration. I start with the text as my inspiration for my interpretation of the piece. And that starts with diction, the style of diction for a choir. For an orchestra, if it's programmatic, you know, you can simply think about the room that you're performing in. Is it a reverberant room? Is it a drier room? There's so many things that I sort of take into account when I'm sort of preparing a piece. I'm preparing Verdi Requiem with my choirs here in New York City, and the venue is Trinity Church Wall Street. So I'm thinking and preparing the choir about some of those pauses. They will be grander than maybe if it was a performance at Carnegie Hall, which is not as reverberant. I'm also thinking about the makeup of the group. Sometimes I enjoy a career working with amateurs and also professional musicians. And I feel very thankful to be able to bridge that world. But there's considerations to be made when working with those different groups.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So we're so excited to have you coming to Buffalo, or back sort of to Western New York, on March 29th and 30th for Sanctuary, the program entitled Sanctuary Road, but there are other things inside of the program. What initially drew you to Sanctuary Road?
Well, Sanctuary Road is a Grammy-nominated composition. The recording was nominated for a Grammy, and I was fortunate enough to appear on that recording as the baritone soloist. So I've had a lot of experience with this piece. Also, my dear friend Paul Moravec, who is also a native of Buffalo, is a composer. And I've been singing and conducting this piece for about 6 years now. Even once in Cincinnati, I sang the solos and conducted at the same time because the conductor became ill. And I'm a conductor, so we made that work out. But it's especially important, and I think it'll be very poignant to bring this piece to Western New York, given the role of Buffalo and Niagara Falls in the Underground Railroad. So I performed this piece in Charleston, South Carolina, and that was particularly moving to think about some of the stories that actually took place in that region.
How did the entirety of the program, which includes Margaret Bond's Montgomery Variations, come together?
Margaret Bonds has been the subject of my research and scholarship for almost 10 years now. I have produced three editions of her symphonic choral works, of three cantatas. And I think that in any program, it's important to have a variety of voices that are represented. And to have Margaret Bonds' symphonic voice represented on this program, her settings and variations of spirituals and freedom songs seem to be the perfect addition to this program to really feature the outstanding Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra.
As we listen to the program, what do you hope we as an audience experience in the themes?
This piece is full of soaring melodies and vivid storytelling. And I think everyone can relate to these characters because it illuminates courage, resilience, and humanity, things that we can all really bring to our own lives. Human rights is at the center of the piece. So that I hope that people can walk away, especially during this time in our country, with feelings of empathy for those who are seeking dignity in this country.
Thank you. I hate that we live in a world where I even have to ask this question, but I would like to ask it anyway, and asking, why is programming pieces like Sanctuary Road and the Montgomery Variations so important?
The performance of these two works is so important because it's American history. As we embark on the 250th anniversary of this country, there's going to be a lot of programming And the stories of escaped enslaved people is, sorry, I'm going to say that, start over.
Sure.
The stories of enslaved persons that escaped, as recorded by William Still, are American stories. Margaret Bonds is an American composer, and her settings of these amazing melodies need to be shared with audiences.
What do you hope that people who attend the BPO are discussing on the drive home?
That's a good question. I can tell you that after studying this piece and after my first performance of this piece, I didn't know a lot of these stories. The character that the baritone plays that I premiered is about Henry Box Brown, who was the enslaved man that taught himself to read and write. He worked hard, even as an enslaved person, to earn money to mail himself from Raleigh all the way to Philadelphia. And he enclosed himself in a shipping crate with a little vial of water, a couple of biscuits, and a hole to make sure that he could have oxygen. And I would imagine that people driving home and walking from Klein Hans will just be mesmerized with the storytelling and the true narratives that they've heard.
My final question is a little bit of a departure from Sanctuary Road and the Montgomery Variations, but I will include all of the ticket information inside of the show notes. But as someone who was from Western New York, I'd love to end the interview by asking, what advice might you give a young person in Grand Island who might hear this podcast and might be considering a career in music?
That is an awesome question. I've always listened to my gut and followed my dreams. And I haven't gotten to where I am today by myself, of course. I've had a whole host of teachers. Of course, my family is at the forefront of the success that I've experienced. But it is also come down to really following my passion and love for music and working really hard. A career in music is not for the faint of heart. I spend many hours throughout the week practicing and preparing for performances and rehearsals, and it takes a discipline that other careers might not require. So I would say go for it if you are committed to living a life of discipline.
Thank you. Those are my questions, but I always like to end an interview by asking, was there anything left unsaid or anything that you'd like to share with our listeners? And if the answer is no, that's totally fine, but I always like to leave the door open just in case.
Yes, I would just like to say that Sanctuary Road, this oratorio, is a beautiful collaboration between Paul Moravec and Mark Campbell, the librettist. So I've gotten to know these two men very well over the past 6 years, and they're both Caucasian white men telling these stories, but I have really appreciated, and I'm so thankful for their partnership and for their allyship in bringing these stories to audiences throughout this entire country, and hopefully someday around the world. I don't think the piece has been performed internationally yet, but I'm sure it will at some point.
Great. Dr. Malcolm Murrayweather, thank you so much for your time. It was really fantastic to speak with you today. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Paul and Malcolm. Sanctuary Road will be presented by the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra on Saturday, March 29th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, March 30th at 2:30 p.m. at Klein Hans Music Hall.
Tickets are available in the show notes and at bpo.org. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Sarah Potter engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.